cord towards it. I pull the cord, make the noise of it inflating, and then climb in. I start pulling imaginary people into the raft, struggling with each of them until I count and have 10 survivors. I then, careful with this one, pass out for an awkwardly long period of time. Trust me on this. On the second day of school, with a teacher passed out on the floor after crashing in a plane and swimming on the carpet, an awkwardly long period of time is very short. I come to, pretend to see land, and then hand paddle to it. I pull the raft up onto the beach and discover a deserted island. After some byplay, I make helicopter sounds, wave it down, and then simulate the wind of its landing. I become the copter pilot, stepping out and tell the survivors that I have never seen this island on any map, and I was blown off course, and I'm unsure that I will be able to locate it again. My copter can only accommodate 5 passengers, so 5 will come back to safety, and 5 will have to survive on the island. It's up to the class to decide who will be saved and who will be left behind. They're to form collaborative groups of 3 or 4 students each and come to a consensus. I provide them with a list of the 10 characters who have survived the crash. Each of these characters is designed to cause a debate as to whether they should stay or go. For example, one is a botanist who is also the mom of 2 young children. Some will want to keep her on the island for her knowledge of plants, and others will want to return her to her children. Another example is a convicted murderer who is on parole. Some students won't want to give him one of the 5 seats home. Other students may not want to leave 4 people on the island with him. The whole idea is to create characters that will spark a debate and differences in opinion. This exercise accomplishes 2 main goals. First, they are once again socked in the stomach with an outrageous and outside-the-box intro to the period that is not only bizarre, but highly entertaining. Secondly, I get the chance to discuss group dynamics, the collaborative process, and the procedures we use to get into groups, all in the context of a fun, engaging activity that does not have any particular right or wrong answers. The answer to who is rescued and who stays on the island doesn't matter. It's the process that is important. I emphasize that they must not only come to a consensus, but they must be able to justify their answers. As the groups collaborate, I circulate through the room and monitor the process. I reinforce proper dynamics, the no-meanness rule, and encourage full participation. Once finished, each group reports their answers and responds to any questions I might have about their choices. It is always interesting to see how different the answers can be and how the justifications vary from group to group and from period to period. I track the responses on a chart on the board. After 2 days, every student has introduced themselves to the whole class and has participated in a collaborative group. In addition, they have yet to see anything resembling an ordinary class experience. They leave wondering what in the world is going to happen next. I'll tell you what's going to happen next. Just the single most important day of the school year. Day 3. Day 3. If I were to rank all of my 180 class days in order of importance, I would probably rank day 3 as the single most critical of the year. This is the day I explain the method to my madness and break down all possibilities of students falling into a self-fulfilling prophecy of failure. I teach many students who have struggled in school and failed many times before they arrive at my door. I know many of them are asking an unspoken question that is absolutely critical for me to be able to answer. I visualize them sitting in front of me and asking this silent question. Why will I be successful in your class if I've never been successful before? Until and unless I can answer that question, I don't believe I can effectively start my year. Day 3 consists of a massive, high-energy, frenetic sales pitch designed to convince my students that my class is completely different from anything they have ever experienced in school. Most importantly, I work to sell them on the fact that they can and absolutely will be successful. Far too many of our students have been beaten up by school. They have been told they don't measure up. They have been made to believe their unique gifts and talents are not valued by the educational system because they are not reflected in test scores. They don't believe that school respects and honors their individuality, but instead uses it against them as a tool to force conformity. Every student in your class in those first few days of the semester is evaluating whether or not your room is an emotionally and psychologically safe environment. They're wondering if it's worth their time and effort to give school a real shot. After all, it's easier to not give your best and then to blame failure on a lack of effort than to be forced to realize you really don't have what it takes. At least you can save face with your peers when you fail if you don't try in the first place. None of this is ever verbally expressed. However, if you teach the same clientele I do, you know this is what some of them are thinking. It's our job as teachers to address the unspoken thoughts rattling around in the minds of our students. The earlier we do it, the better. My goal is to completely smash any idea my students might have about my class being more of the same for them. I will pull out all the stops to convince them it doesn't matter if they have failed before because my class is absolutely and completely different. My class has been specially designed for them to be successful. It is based on the latest brain research and incorporates incredible mnemonics designed to help them easily learn and retain more content in less time. I explain to them how the brain works and how a positive learning environment is critical for higher order thinking to take place. I talk to them about learning styles. I spend a great deal of time discussing Howard Gardner's theory of multiple intelligences. I give them compelling examples of how school systems have consistently neglected and undervalued many of these types of intelligences because they are not on the test. I show how special gifts and talents, like artistic and musical creativity, should be equally valued in school. I talk to the athletes and dancers about kinesthetic intelligence. I give them examples of how people with interpersonal intelligence might find themselves in trouble in school, but have incredible opportunities for success in the real world. I do not have a casual, nonchalant attitude about this day. Make no mistake about it. I'm selling. I believe great teaching incorporates many of the same skills and techniques used in successful salesmanship and marketing, and I use them all. By offering a powerfully compelling and engaging argument, I am attempting to fully persuade my students that they will be successful. I'm spinning the story to the best of my ability. But the difference between me and the PR masters who spin stories for the media is that I'm convinced that what I'm selling is absolutely worthy of the effort. Marketers spend billions of dollars in untold hours trying to sell people products that don't even come close in significance to what I'm selling. I'm selling education, a life-altering product that can transform the human spirit and literally change the world one student at a time. Surely, such a product is worthy of any and all efforts, techniques, and methods required to successfully persuade. At the very least, I want the most difficult and stubborn student in my class to leave with an open mind and say to themselves, okay, maybe this guy is onto something. I'll give this a shot and see what happens. Boom. I got him. That opening is all I need. Next comes the fun part. Living up to my pitch and providing a course that knocks their socks off and rocks their world. How do you do that? Just keep listening. Ask and analyze. Always the beautiful answer. Who asks a more beautiful question? E.E. Cummings. The important thing is to not stop questioning. Albert Einstein. Questions are the laser of human consciousness. Anthony Robbins. One of the most frequent questions I'm asked is, how can I become more creative when I'm designing my lessons? More often, actually, it sounds something like this. I love all of your examples, but how can I add those types of presentations to my lessons when I'm not as creative as you are? Questions like that tell me I'm speaking to yet another person who has fallen victim to what I call the myth of the blinding flash of light. Many people believe only two kinds of people exist in this world, those who are creative and those who are not. The people who believe this, of course, have usually already classified themselves into the latter category. They believe creative people simply walk around and are suddenly struck by creative ideas, much like a bright flash of light. They are frustrated by the absence of that flash of light in their own lives. If only I could get those same flashes of insight and creativity, they lament. It's not fair. Maybe certain types of genius individuals, like Einstein, receive those flashes, but that's not how creativity happens for most people. For most of us, creative genius is developed through hard work, directed attention, and relentless engagement in the creative process. What is the creative process? To a large extent, is the process of consistently asking the right questions. I learned one of my most life-transforming concepts from motivational speaker and author Anthony Robbins. The concept is the unbelievable importance and significance of questions. The types of questions we ask ourselves determine the type of answers that we receive. If you consistently ask questions that lead to creative and outside-the-box thinking, your mind will provide you with creative and outside-the-box answers. Asking the right questions is like tuning the radio to the correct frequency. Most people go through life listening to creative static because they have failed to properly tune their mind to the right station. In fact, most people don't even realize they have the ability to be creative, so they don't even bother to turn on the radio. The quality of your questions determines the quality of your answers, and the type of questions determines the type of ideas your brain will receive and conceive. A teacher approached me after attending one of my workshops and told me that he really liked my examples of how I take my classes outside of the room for multiple lessons. He went on to say that he couldn't think of any similar ideas for his classes. The question I asked him next revealed the reason he was stuck. I asked, "When you are designing your lessons, do you ask yourself, is there a way I can get my class outside of the room for this lesson? Or have you asked, where is the best place on campus to deliver this lesson?" His answer, of course, was no. How could he expect to find a creative way to get his class outside if he never asked the question? He was waiting for the blinding flash of light. Are you? If you ask yourself, where is the best place on campus to deliver this lesson? You might find that the answer is not your room. You'll never know if you don't ask. We can tweak and refine the questions to make them even better. For example, how can I get my class outside for this lesson is better than is there a way, because the latter allows for the mind to take the easy way out and just say no. Even better might be to ask, how many different ways can I find to get my class outside for this lesson? Now the question naturally leads towards receiving multiple solutions rather than being satisfied with one. The ability to manipulate questions to make them even more effective is crucial to success in the creative process. Another teacher approached me after a workshop, frustrated with his inability to think of any creative board message ideas. I put the same question to him. Have you ever asked yourself, what could I write on my board for this lesson that would spark a conversation or create a buzz even before the bell rings? You can guess his answer. Creative ideas don't come out of the blue. They come from engaging in the creative process. That critical process starts when you ask the right types of questions and then actively seek the answers. What we experience in our life is a direct result of our focus. Here's a real life experience that drives home this truth. See if you can relate. Several years ago, my family entered the minivan stage. With two young children, we needed a more spacious form of transportation. My wife said we needed to think about getting a minivan. I knew absolutely nothing about minivans. I had never driven one. I didn't even know any of the brand names. To my recollection, I had never even ridden in one. Up to that point, the amount of time I had spent thinking about minivans was exactly zero. After a little online research, we visited the Honda dealership to test drive an Odyssey. I can honestly say I had no idea what an Odyssey was until that day. Afterwards, we crossed the street to test drive a Sienna at the Toyota dealership. I preferred the Odyssey, so we went back to the Honda dealership and bought a brand new silver Odyssey. On that day, at that moment, something absolutely amazing happened. Thousands and thousands of people got Odysseys at the exact same time as me. I saw them everywhere. On the way home, I passed Odyssey after Odyssey. A Honda Odyssey merged into traffic in front of me. I pulled up to a stoplight right behind an Odyssey. I looked in the rearview mirror, and there was one behind me as well. At the supermarket, I parked between two Honda Odysseys. Three times since my purchase, I have actually opened the door to someone else's Honda Odyssey. Have you ever experienced that awkward moment when you realize it's someone else's stuff in the car you just opened the door to? I have, and the only thing you can do is quickly close the door, walk away, and hope no one saw you trying to get into a stranger's car. I know you know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Did everybody get a Honda Odyssey the same day I did? No? Are you trying to tell me that all those Odysseys were there the whole time? Yes? Then why didn't I see them? The answer reveals something incredible about the human mind. we are hit with so much information and stimuli that our brain cannot hope to process it all. We simply can't make sense of the world without a mental filter. The brain learns to attend to stimuli that it believes are important to you and to delete or filter out everything else. Until we needed a minivan, Odysseys weren't important to me. I never focused on them or even gave them a second thought, so they just registered to my brain as car in the generic. Once I had an Odyssey and it was a part of my life, my brain automatically attended to them and registered them as something special and different from just any car. I'm sure you've had a similar experience. No sooner do you get involved or interested in a new subject than out of nowhere, you see an article about it, a news report on it, and overhear other people discussing it in conversation. Your reticular activating system, your RAS, the same neurological system that filters out unnecessary stimuli, begins to search for and point out thoughts, images, words, people, and places you never noticed before. Suddenly, your mental radio, your RAS, picks up an all-new frequency, and it's tuned into your subject of interest. The same principle holds true for creative ideas. Just like the Odysseys, creative ideas are all around us all the time. Creative inspiration is constantly at our disposal, but we will never see it unless we actively and consistently attempt to create. By asking the right questions, you tune your RAS into your need for creative inspiration and solutions. Suddenly, clarity and creativity seem inescapable. On a recent trip to Mobile, Alabama, I witnessed the power of this neurological phenomenon in action. I was presenting 3 days of workshops for the social studies teachers in the Mobile County school system. My friend Nate Smith, the social studies coordinator, booked the event at the beautiful Museum of Mobile. After attending the day-long workshop, teachers were to tour the museum. We wanted them to see this excellent but underutilized local resource that was perfect for field trips. My workshop room was on the first floor, just down the hall from the museum's gift shop. On our first break, many teachers browsed the shop, but very few made a purchase. Later in the day, we discussed the power of adding hooks to presentations and began to actively engage in the creative process. During the next break, the teachers went back into the shop. On this visit, they viewed almost every item as a potential prop for a lesson or a creative way to engage the class. Multiple teachers came up to me over the 3 days to show me what they had purchased and explain how they planned to use it. Teachers walked out of the museum each evening carrying gift shop bags filled with all sorts of strange items. I should have received a commission. What changed between their first visit to the gift shop, when nothing seemed interesting, and the next visit, when everything held potential as a prop or a classroom tool? The inventory didn't change. In fact, the exact items were in the shop the first time the teachers walked through. Those items just didn't register as significant or related to them. After engaging in the creative process, the same teachers experienced the world in a completely different way. By changing their focus and activating the creative genius that resides inside each of us, they were transported into a world of abundance, one where incredible ideas were all around them for the taking. The same thing can happen for you. Creativity is rarely about natural brilliance or innate genius. Much more often, creativity results from properly directed attention, laser-like focus, relentless effort, and hard work. Outsiders see the glorious results, but know very little about the blood and sweat that happens behind closed doors. Creative genius is something people tend to romanticize, but the reality is not very romantic at all. Like any skill, it takes practice and effort. No one assumes that an accomplished doctor, rocket scientist, or engineer lucked their way into greatness. We have a certain understanding and appreciation for the years of study, sacrifice, and hard work it takes for these experts to reach the highest levels of their profession. Yet when we see accomplished artists and exceptionally creative people, we jump to the conclusion that their talent is God-given or natural. Most people would be surprised to pull back the curtain and see the years of excruciating labor, relentless pursuit of excellence, and monstrous obstacles those naturals have overcome. The six words. Anytime I speak to a group of educators, whether it is a workshop, keynote address, or conference session, I tell the following story. You almost have to hear it live for it to have its full impact and intensity. I'm a very passionate and enthusiastic speaker, but when I tell this story, my energy and intensity ramps up to astronomical levels. Afterwards, if people talk to me about a story from the day, it is inevitably this one. My book wouldn't be complete without an attempt to share this story. I hope I can do it justice. Several years ago, a former colleague asked me for some advice. We were teaching many of the same students, and she was having a very difficult time with behavior management and just about everything else. When I say she was struggling, I mean she was close to having a breakdown and flat out leaving the profession. She knew from the constant buzz about my class that I was having success with these same students, so she asked me if we could discuss some of my techniques and strategies. Well, I love to discuss these ideas with fellow teachers, so my answer was an automatic yes. We met the next day, and within the first 5 minutes of our conversation, she said the six words that got me unbelievably fired up. Using only six words, she said two very sinister things that carry very serious implications. Now, when she said the six words, I said thank you, because she was giving me credit for a very desirable character trait. It wasn't until later that I realized why I had such an uncomfortable response to her six words. Walking away from that meeting, the disturbing nature of those six words suddenly hit me, and I immediately realized why I had such a visceral reaction to them. Apparently, you can say a lot in six words. Right about now, some of you are ready to scream, "Just tell me the six words!" If you were listening to the story live, you'd be ready to shake the words out of me. It's worth pointing out this reaction is not unintentional. The building up of the story incorporates elements of classic storytelling technique. First, a preview to the story explains its importance and impact in a way that hopefully helps to build anticipation. Then, the most essential element of the story, the six words, is strategically kept from you. The story could begin with the six words, but I've made a presentational decision to not reveal them until later in the story in an effort to build dramatic tension. All of these elements are examples of what can be done when presenting content in the classroom. What a great place to be in, where your audience is ready to strangle you if you don't tell them the very content that you are trying so desperately to deliver. It changes the positioning of the situation and creates an entirely different dynamic. Now back to the six words. The six words were... Now when I tell you the six words, some of you will think they aren't such a big deal, but some of you will get it right away. Hopefully by the end of the story, it will sink in for everyone. She said, "It's easy for you. You're creative." Wow. Let me repeat that. It's easy for you. You're creative. The first sinister implication can be found in the first four words. It's easy for you. It's easy for me? Really? So with four words, she dismissed 17 years of hard work, 17 years of brainstorming, 17 years worth of notebook after notebook filled with ideas. Most of which sucked. 17 years of failures and lessons that blew up in my face. 17 years of fine-tuning ideas and making adjustments because what I thought were great ideas went completely wrong. 17 years of having to abandon lessons partway through the day in order to salvage something useful. I've worked my butt off to build a class that is outrageously engaging, fun, educationally sound, and dearly loved by my students. It wasn't easy when I started. It wasn't easy last week. And it won't be easy next week either. It's not supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be worth it. You can build something incredible if you put the effort in on the front end and then keep putting the effort in until you turn the lights off and close your door for the last time. But it won't be easy. The risk faced by anyone who has achieved a high level of skill and polish in any particular field is that since they make it look so easy, some will assume it was. I'm convinced the concept of the natural is entirely erroneous. It's only through relentless practice that these professionals can fool you into believing it to be so. The second sinister implication can be found in words 5 and 6. You're creative. What is she implying by that? She's implying two things. First, she's implying I have some sort of inborn character trait known as creativity. Secondly, and more importantly, she is implying she is not creative. She wasn't given this particular trait, so she is excused from doing the same hard work I put in. Her lack of natural creative ability therefore excuses her for the fact that her class sucks. It excuses her from the fact that kids aren't learning successfully and reaching their potential in her class. And she gets a pass on the fact that students leave her class with less of a level of learning than when they started. Oh, no, she doesn't. It's not okay to throw up your hands in defeat because you're not naturally creative. Few, if any, teachers are innately creative. I know I'm being harsh, but I'm trying to make an important point. Education can be used to uplift and inspire, or it can be used as a hammer to bludgeon and beat down. We must collectively agree, educating the next generation is worth the time and effort, and that our students deserve to be uplifted and inspired. Creativity is not the possession of some special class of artistic individuals, but is rather something that can be nurtured and developed in all of us, including your students. As a disclaimer, the teacher I'm referring to is a very nice woman who cares deeply about kids and was honestly trying to get better at her profession. She would be horrified to think that she was implying these things, and I'm positive meant no offense. That's why I thanked her, and we continued to make some real strides forward. I'm 100% behind anyone who wants to improve, and I applaud her for caring enough to seek guidance and taking the risk of asking me for assistance. But I know I have to keep telling this story. Why? Because too many teachers use those six words as an excuse. Case in point, I visited with several teachers following a conference session in Monterey, California, when one of them, thank you, Mary, gave me some interesting insight. She had been in the women's bathroom immediately after this session and overheard several ladies discussing my session. One of the ladies mentioned the six words story and said that it felt like a punch to her stomach. Up to that point in the session, she had been sitting there thinking to herself the exact same thing. Easy for him. He's the creative magician guy. I could never pull this stuff off. Hearing the story, she realized I was talking about her. It challenged her to reconsider her belief that creativity is something you either have or you don't have. Because she could relate to the six words and realize their fallacy, she was willing to step out of her comfort zone and give some of my methods a shot. That's all I'm asking for, an open mind and the willingness to suspend disbelief in your creative ability. Have faith that what I'm telling you is true. We all have unbelievable creative potential. It lies dormant, just waiting, no begging to be tapped. I haven't presented a workshop or a keynote address since that day without including the six words. I can't tell you how many people have come up to me and said they appreciated the story because they have heard similar sentiments expressed to them. Don't doubt for a minute that you are a creative wellspring that will soon be releasing a flood of awesome ideas into the world. The real law of attraction. I have to come clean. I lied to you when I told you that the blinding flash of light theory about creativity is a myth. It really isn't a myth. You absolutely will receive creative inspirations out of nowhere and at the oddest times, but you will only get them if you put in the work on the front end. Those flashes of inspiration will only come when you have tuned your mind to the correct frequency by engaging in the creative process and asking the right questions. Don't be frustrated by a lack of results in a brainstorming session or while trying to add creative presentational hooks to your lessons. Participating in the process and creating a vision of the outrageously high engagement level you desire from your students is the necessary first step. Then, and only then, you will be stunned by the fact that your brain will continue to work overtime, consciously and subconsciously, to fulfill your goals and vision. When you ask the right questions, your brain won't be satisfied until it has provided the answers. Remember, the quality of your questions is critical. Don't ask, how can I make this lesson bearable for my students today and keep them awake? Unless you want an answer that requires the bare minimum. Instead, ask, how can I make this lesson outrageously entertaining, engaging, and powerful so that my students will never forget it and will be desperate to come back for more? That is a qualitatively different question and will lead to a qualitatively different answer. Your brain won't be satisfied until it has received a proper and fitting response. My problem with many interpretations of the law of attraction is that it makes it sound like you just wish for a new car and someone drives one into your driveway and gives it to you. It doesn't work like that. To put the real law of attraction to work for you, you must create a vision of what you want and define the goals you want to achieve, and then you must start working for them. Once you have a vision and a fixed destination and started out after it, you will be shocked at how much assistance you receive along the way. As William H. Murray poignantly said, "Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans, that the moment one definitely commits oneself, the providence moves too. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents, meetings, and material assistance, which no man could have dreamt would have come his way. Commit. Start working. Then be open. Recognize this providential assistance when it comes and leap to take advantage of it. Don't dismiss the ideas that your brain is trying to send you. Many people are on the receiving end of incredible amounts of creative ideas, but either don't recognize them as such or don't have the confidence to act. Ideas are great, but implementation is the key to results. Inspiration without implementation is a waste. In my all-day version of the Teach Like a Pirate seminar, as well as my Teaching Outside the Box workshop, teachers spend time working collaboratively to brainstorm ideas for their own lessons. They use a creativity tool I developed called the Ultimate Kick Butt, No Holds Barred, Super Turbocharged Lesson Plan Brainstorming Power Pack System. Sorry, sometimes my inner copywriter gets the best of me. I have seen unbelievably creative lesson plan ideas come out of these sessions, ideas that are all for naught unless those teachers follow through on the next steps of the creative process. To make a difference in your classroom, your ideas must be developed and then, ultimately, implemented in front of students. Based on feedback from teachers across the world, I know many of these ideas and strategies have found their way off the brainstorming page and into classrooms where they belong. I still remember getting an email, complete with pictures, from Mary Bear Sylvia, a teacher who attended a one-hour, super abbreviated Teach Like a Pirate conference session. She received creative inspiration and had the courage to run with it. She came up with her idea, developed it, and brought it to fruition in her classroom 2 days after the conference. That's implementation. You have probably heard the story about the man who stood on his roof during a flood and waited for God to save him. A rescue boat came to get him, and he said he was fine and that God would help him. Another rescue boat came and begged him to get in, but he rejected the help. Finally, a helicopter flew overhead and dropped a ladder to him, but he refused to go, proclaiming his faith in the Lord. The waters topped his roof, and he drowned. Upon entering heaven, he was indignant and confronted God. "How could you let me die up there on that roof after all the faith I've had in you?" God replied, "Come on, I sent you 2 boats and a helicopter." Don't be that guy. Jump on creative ideas and opportunities that come your way and then implement them. Be proactive in your pursuit of your vision for your classroom and life. The law of attraction is real. Your thoughts are magical and have the power to manifest your dreams, but not without your active participation in the process. Design a system to capture ideas. Your subconscious mind does not work at the same pace as your conscious mind. Brilliant ideas will come to you in the strangest of circumstances. They will come to you in the shower, at the gym, and while driving in your car. They will hit you in the grocery store, on a walk, and while getting a haircut. Some of my best ideas come while doing the dishes, cleaning the house, or doing other activities when the conscious brain is on autopilot. Since these ideas often surface at odd times, you will want to be perpetually prepared to capture them. Don't say, "I'll write that down when I get home." You won't. In fact, you likely won't even remember you had an idea in the first place. Instead, create a system for immediately capturing and organizing your ideas so they are not lost forever. I get sick to my stomach when I think of all the ideas I lost because I was sure I would remember them. Sometimes I'll see an ex-student and they'll mention something they remember from a class years ago. Inevitably, I think, why don't I do that anymore? I don't do it because I didn't write it down. I forgot how powerful that particular element was to the lesson. To prevent idea evaporation, I developed a habit years ago of traveling with an index card and a pen in my pocket at all times. I used these to jot down thoughts and ideas I wanted to remember. When I emptied my pockets each evening, I put the notes where I could find them later, a file, notebook, etc. Now that I have a smartphone with me at all times, I have transitioned to using a note-taking app for the same purpose. There are any number of amazing apps, such as Evernote, that can assist you in capturing and organizing your ideas. Whatever system you choose, just make sure it's always available to you and that you actually use it. Don't buy some fancy organizational notebook or buy some complicated app that you will never use. The simpler your idea capture system is, the better. Choose practicality over flash. Your system doesn't have to be high-tech. I tend to create a manila file folder or a three-ring notebook for any project I'm working on. I still have the notebook I used when I first developed the original Teach Like a Pirate seminar and the whole pirate mnemonic. It has tabs for each letter and is filled with random thoughts, ideas, and brainstorming results. I filled the pockets with index cards and scraps of paper with quotes and reminders. Years later, I can look back and see all of the possibilities I considered when generating the Teach Like a Pirate system. Make it easy. The point of your idea capture system, as well as the implementation of those ideas, is to keep it simple and easily accessible. The more steps you are required to do before you can actually be productive, the less likely it is that you will be consistently successful. This is true of fitness programs as well, by the way. One study found that the distance of your workout facility directly correlates to how frequently you use it. The greater the distance, the less likely you are to go to the gym on a daily basis. I know for me, the single biggest change I originally made when I began to lose 40 pounds of excess weight was to walk. The reason was simple. All I had to do was open my door and go. Whatever system you develop to record your ideas, organize your thoughts, and develop your plans for implementation, make sure it is quick and easy to use. For me, to get this book written, I decided to take my own advice. I invested in a Mac Air, which gave me the portability to work anywhere. When I was tied to my desktop in a particular space, I was far less successful. Now I can write on planes, in any room in the house. Important when you have young children. Literally anywhere in the world, I am writing these very words on a spring break vacation in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. The easier you make it to work, the more likely you will. Developing a system to capture your ideas has an additional benefit. You are telling yourself that you are, indeed, going to get some creative insights. This can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Capturing your thoughts validates their worth, an act that sends the subtle but powerful message to your subconscious that the effort spent on idea generation won't be squandered. Failure versus feedback. I mentioned earlier that I've had lessons blow up in my face and a long series of failures in the classroom. It's absolutely true. I have had legendary failures. I have had out-and-out disasters occur as I've tried to develop and implement my ideas. I'm not even completely satisfied with all of my lessons from last week because I know they could have been better. It goes with the territory. If you haven't failed in the classroom lately, you aren't pushing the envelope far enough. Safe lessons are a recipe for mediocrity at best. The key to failing without quitting is to shift your paradigm to believe there is no such thing as true failure, only feedback. When you have a vision for how you want your class to be, you can then analyze the results. Use those results, aka feedback, for improvement. For example, if you notice that your class is not engaged by your presentation, it isn't helpful or empowering to blame your students. Obviously, if they're not engaged, they are providing you with some critical feedback. What you're doing is not engaging for this audience on this day. Try to evaluate and learn from that feedback without taking it too personally. Doing so will allow you to make adjustments and improve your future presentations. The truly skilled practitioner has the sensory acuity to read the audience's engagement level and make real-time adjustments on the fly. That's the ultimate goal, and although difficult, it is attainable. Don't get so wrapped up in what you are doing and what is listed next on your agenda that you fail to see the feedback that is being constantly provided by your audience. I still remember reading Psycho-Cybernetics by Maxwell Maltz as a youngster. His comparison of the way humans attain their goals to the way missiles and torpedoes hit their targets had a profound impact on me. Dr. Maltz said, "The torpedo accomplishes its goal by going forward, making errors, and continually correcting them. By a series of zigzags, it literally gropes its way to the goal. In fact, the missile is likely to be off target a far greater percentage of the time than it is on target. Nevertheless, it arrives and hits its target because of the constant adjustments made based on continual analysis of the feedback provided. Similarly, the path to great teaching looks like instructions for washing your hair. Try, fail, adjust, try, fail, adjust, lather, rinse, repeat. After a recent seminar presentation, a woman approached me and thanked me for admitting I still fail. She said she found it intimidating to listen to professional development speakers who make it sound as if their classes are perfect. These speakers don't let on that they experience the trials and tribulations we all know are a part of this, heck, any profession. Perhaps they are concerned that they'll lose credibility by showing vulnerability, but they are completely wrong. My goal is to provide a realistic look into the classroom, and that simply can't be done without talking about failure. In my opinion, any endeavor that doesn't hold the possibility of failure can't accomplish anything meaningful. The idea of the perfect school year doesn't, thank God, exist. Don't let that stop you from attempting something new. Instead, be encouraged to push the edge and reach new heights. Just bring lots of bandages for the knees you're going to scrape along the way. Creative alchemy. Becoming well-read and involved in a wide variety of interests provides us with the raw resources that we need for what I call creative alchemy. Too often, people believe creativity is some esoteric skill that involves with coming up with completely original ideas from out of the blue. That is rarely the way it works. I liken real creativity more to these definitions of alchemy. Alchemy. 1. The magical process of transmuting a common substance, usually of little value, into a substance of great value. 2. A process by which paradoxical results are achieved by the combination of incompatible elements. Spend more time on your passions, hobbies, and outside areas of interest, and then seek ways to incorporate them into your classroom. Cultivate new hobbies and watch new areas of your brain explode in creative output. Watch your life light up with a new energy as you rekindle the feelings you had for the passions of your younger days. Grow, try new things, and do those bucket list items. Notice the world around you and treat it like the bountiful supply of creative ideas that it is. It's not just good for your life. It's great for your teaching. Exploring the world and your passions allows you to bring a new perspective and energy into the classroom. It allows you to become a powerful role model for your students. We always say we want them to be lifelong learners, so we must show them what that looks like. Creative stagnation is often a result of 1, being unwilling to venture outside of our expertise, 2, an inability to see how seemingly unrelated ideas can be combined into something new and powerful. I believe the best books to read about teaching are rarely in the education section. I always have 3 or 4 books on my nightstand, a book in my car, one in my school bag, and several more on my phone. I consider it one of the most important parts of my job to constantly expose myself to the high-quality thinking of other people. It challenges me, it keeps me current, and it provides me with the raw resources necessary for creative alchemy. My outside interests are wide, varied, and growing. Here are some examples: magic, origami, chess, coaching basketball, fitness, entrepreneurship, direct marketing, social media, rap music, success literature, public speaking, civil rights, and most recently, the Rubik's Cube. When I only focus on my teaching, I'm not nearly as creative as when I find time to humor my strange obsessions. Examples of creative alchemy are everywhere. Jazz was made through creative alchemy. Rock and roll, creative alchemy. Rap music, creative alchemy. Forgive me for dating myself, but I still remember when Run-DMC added a rock guitar to many of their rap songs and created a new sound. Artists increase their creativity by experimenting with different mediums. Musicians experience watershed moments of creativity after becoming influenced by other bands, artists, and styles. Marketers design brilliant campaigns after exposing themselves to methods of other industries and then seeking to apply the ideas to their own. Here is alchemy at work. 1. For years, I have incorporated origami, one of my outside interests, into my history class, but I was always frustrated that I had no use for the narrow strip of paper left over after cutting 200 8.5 by 11.5 pieces of paper into a square. 2. I have also been frustrated for the past few years with my 1920s Henry Ford assembly line simulation. I didn't like the final product of the activity and had, in fact, stopped doing it for a couple years. 3. A couple years ago, I saw a student create a helicopter out of a narrow piece of paper. I asked him to teach it to me, and I put it in my file of ideas to use at some point in the future. After 2 years, I repeat, 2 years, the creative alchemy finally worked its magic. How long should you wait for a good idea? As long as it takes. Now, I use the strips of paper for the raw materials that I need to turn each class into several competing teams of helicopter-making assembly lines during my Henry Ford lesson. I solve the answer to my wasted strips of paper problem, my assembly line problem, and the problem of how to use the cool principle taught to me by a student. This semester was my first attempt, and I think it's going to be a keeper. Alchemy. Don't fall into the trap of thinking time spent developing yourself into a well-rounded person above and beyond your role as an educator is wasted or something to feel guilty about. It's essential and will pay dividends in not only your life, but also in your classroom. Transformation. Provide an uncommon experience for your students, and they will reward you with an uncommon effort and attitude. Dave Burgess. For many students, school is filled with monotony, drudgery, and soul-killing suckiness. When I think about a student's typical school day, it makes me completely understand why so many of them don't want to be there. Too often, school is a place where creativity is systematically killed, individuality is stamped out, and boredom reigns supreme. There are really only two possibilities. Either your class can be a reprieve from all of that, or it can be a contributing factor. I am thoroughly committed to having my class be a reprieve. I want my class to stand out in the sea of sameness that is the educational landscape. I want my class to be, as Seth Godin says, a purple cow. In his book by the same title, Seth writes, "Something remarkable is worth talking about, worth noticing, exceptional, new, interesting. It's a purple cow. Boring stuff is invisible. It's a brown cow." Although his book was written for marketers, it validates much of what I believe is true in teaching. Students are hit with so much information and stimuli every day that to stand out in their minds, you must be remarkable. Remarkable means that you are so exceptional and different that people talk about you in a good way. Being merely good doesn't cut it. You have to be extraordinary. I'm always shooting to have the most talked about class on campus and the conference session with the most buzz. That goal isn't about ego. It's about effectiveness. Standing out from the crowd is the only way to guarantee your message is received in a culture that is increasingly distracted and where attention spans are plummeting. If you feel your message is important, and I do, it's worth the effort to go to any length to make sure it's successfully delivered. Too many schools are filled with brown cow classes that blend into the background. I'm relentlessly focused and immersed in the orchestrated effort to be the antithesis of the brown cow. I want entering my room to feel like entering another world. Many years ago, I wrote about how I want my class to be viewed by my students. Written through the eyes of a fictional student, it is reflective of letters and comments I've received from actual students. Quote, "As I walked into SS9 as a new student in Mr. Burgess's class, I was filled with an overwhelming sense of anticipation. I'd heard about his reputation. I'd heard my peers tell all the strange stories, and I most certainly had seen his over-the-top costumes as he paraded around campus. There was no possible way that he could live up to all the hype, and yet, after a few weeks, I realized that Mr. Burgess was even better than advertised. I have never